Well, Salt Lake Tribune movie critic Sean Means, not only one of the most insightful critics in the industry, he's got one of the best memories. He's here this morning to give us a wrap-up of some of his favorite films for 2019. So grab a pencil and jot these down. Good morning and welcome back to the Sundance Reel.
Be here.
Great. Your goal is always to see all of the competition films, dramatic and documentary, at the very least. There's 32. Did you get to them all?
I will get to 29 by the time it's all over. I'll get all the U.S. dramatic competition. Because of changes in the way we cover the festival and whatnot, it's less practical to try to see every single thing. So.
Yeah. What are those changes?
We are concentrating more on the first half of the festival, less on reviews and more on covering the event.
Yeah. Well, I noticed a story about the folks here with the CBD oil. It's something you had covered.
Yep. Last year we had the truck that had the Impossible Burger giving out samples to people, and we thought that was interesting, so we wrote that up. And this year the one of the pop-up lounges was doing CBD products, and that was the first time that had happened, so we thought that was interesting, so went and checked them out.
Okay. You did come up though with a top 10 list, and again, that's of prior to seeing all of the ones.
Yeah, because I had to write that up on Wednesday, and there's still a few that I saw yesterday, and some more I'll see today and tomorrow that could possibly pop in there. But yeah, there have been a lot of good movies this year. I've not seen very many clunkers, which is always a good sign. And it also is, you know, in past years, sometimes the ones that are a little on the dodgier side tend to be like in the next program or the midnight. Although sometimes you get really good midnight films. Last year we had Hereditary, for example. So this year, yeah, it's been a good year so far.
Okay. Well, people can find out the entire top 10 by going online to sltrib.com. Maybe you can just give us a few of the highlights and why you thought these were so.
My favorite movie overall has been Apollo 11. Great documentary. Saw it on the first night. This is a comprehensive and perfectly edited archival look at the first moon mission, first successful trip to the moon. Neil Armstrong, Buzz Aldrin, Michael Collins, and it shows from beginning to end, from launch pad to splashdown, and incorporates footage that has been sitting in cold storage in government vaults for 50 years that has never been seen before, audio that's never been heard before. And I'm a NASA nerd from, you know, boyhood, and I feel like a little cheated that all this stuff has been here all this time and nobody's seen it. But Todd Douglas Miller, the director, and his team compile this stuff amazingly. They take you right through it. They explain the science of it. They explain the some of the more complex maneuvers that were required to make the mission happen. And the sound design on this thing is just incredible. It really, sort of makes you feel like you're there, and it's just, it was incredible from beginning to end. It should be in theaters sometime this spring or early summer. I imagine the distributor wants to get a theatrical run before the 50th anniversary in July. So I'm sure CNN, which co-produced the movie, wants to have it on TV in July. So,
yeah, again, 50th anniversary, just like that, huh?
Uh huh. Yeah, sneaks up on you.
Yeah.
There are a couple of movies that are sort of like quarter life crisis movies that I really liked. Young women in their like 20s and 30s who are like still trying to get their life together. One was Brittany Runs a Marathon. Very funny film about a young woman played by Jillian Bell, who her life is kind of screwed up. She goes to a doctor and is told, she's got to lose weight. And so she reluctantly takes a neighbor's invitation to join a running club. And it's horrible and she hates it at first, but she sort of gets into it and eventually makes the pact that she's going to run the New York City Marathon. And a lot of other things happen in between, of course. That one's really funny, really, really heartwarming. It's what they call a crowd pleaser, sort of movie. The other one is Before You Know It, which involves the director Hannah Pearl Utt and her writing partner Jen Tulloch. They play sisters who operate a rundown live theater in Greenwich Village, where their father is a playwright played by Mandy Patinkin. At one point, when tragedy happens in the family, the sisters find out that their mother, who they thought was dead, is actually alive and well and starring on a soap opera, played by Judith Light. This also gets into some, you know, tough issues about grief and loss and so on, but it is also very funny and very charming.
Yeah, these are both in the U.S. Dramatic
competition. Those are both in the U.S. Dramatic. Yeah.
Uh-huh. And then there was one other one there, The Farewell, that you liked.
Yes. You could make a trilogy, frankly, of these three, because this one has the rapper comedian Awkwafina, who you saw in Crazy Rich Asians and Ocean's 8. She plays a struggling writer who finds out that her grandmother back in China has been diagnosed with cancer and is dying, supposedly dying, and the family has decided not to tell her. And so instead, one of her cousins is getting married, and they're going to throw a big wedding in China for her, for them, and it's going to use that as an excuse to have the whole family come around and say hello to the grandmother, what they think is one last time, but still not telling her.
Yeah, that was interesting, just to how the cultural differences, right? Because
right.
The Chinese, it's like, well, this is our job. We take on the emotional burden of somebody dying.
Right.
Yeah.
And it's, I mean, it's based on a true story. The director, Lulu Wang, first told the story on This American Life a couple years ago. And it is, she finds the humor in sort of the cross-cultural stuff. I mean, the wedding is, you know, massive strangeness as far as like the rituals and the ceremony and the traditions, but it's very heartwarming. And Awkwafina, it turns out, actually she's the real deal. She's actually a strong actress, not just a comedian. So, and I say not just a comedian, but you know what I mean.
Yeah, and one of the ones that I saw early on in the week you had mentioned was To the Stars. Later on, I ended up meeting the screenwriter for that, something that she'd written a long time ago.
Shannon Colleary, she'd been working on this thing for 20 years and been developing this script for 20 years. This is a beautiful coming-of-age story. You've got a wallflower high school girl played by Kara Hayward, and she is bullied and picked on at school. And then one day this new girl comes to town, and she's vivacious and tells stories about big city life and so on, played by Liana Liberato, and they become friends. But I mean, there's complications in this story. It reminded me very much of Last Picture Show, in a sort of, you know, middle America, 1960s, black and white, looking at high schoolers and their sex lives.
And she told me they shot it in color as well.
Yeah, they shot both ways, and that's not uncommon, because partly because you have producers who get nervous about, you know, when directors start talking all arty about, like, we're going to do this in black and white. But it's beautiful, and it works very well.
Here. Yeah, and then just maybe a couple of the world cinema documentaries. These are the ones I think that Sundance just shines with, and just an opportunity to see something that we may not ever see again.
Right. I mean, Midnight Traveler is the one that really just blew me away. Hassan Fazili, who's a Afghan filmmaker, had been trying to get asylum for his family because the Taliban had put a price on his head. And so they were in Tajikistan for a while, and then had to leave Tajikistan and go back to Afghanistan, but they couldn't stay in Afghanistan. So they decided to go the refugee route to make that trek. And this movie, he shot it, he and his wife and their two daughters, they shot this movie on three cell phones. And it captures, you know, having to sleep outside in cold, having to, you know, deal with refugee camps, all this stuff, going from Iran to Turkey to Bulgaria to Serbia. And the journey is just, you know, amazing. And the fact that they were able to do this and get the footage out and everything else is just, it really puts a human face on the whole, you know, people talk about the quote unquote, the refugee crisis and People talk about it in ways that dehumanizes the you know, the plight, the fact that these are actual people with actual, you know, problems. This movie puts it back that way. The other one I really loved was The Magic Life of V, a Finnish movie about a young woman who her hobby is LARPing, live action role play. She goes to events in character and cosplay. And sometimes it's like, you know, mutant alien attack type things. Sometimes it's Hogwarts type things. And we find out that one of the reasons she does this is that it is to help her sort of build up the mental resolve and the courage to face some of the demons going on in her real life. And it's a really intimate, really personal documentary, and it's just beautiful.
The Ted Bundy girlfriend film, is this going to do well in Utah?
I think it's going to do well everywhere. I mean, IMDb, before the festival started, IMDb did a study of the most anticipated films at the festival based on, you know, web searches and whatnot. And the Ted Bundy movie, the title, we keep calling it the Ted Bundy movie, that there it does actually have a title, Extremely Wicked, Shockingly Evil and Vile, which is a great title. It looks at the notion of being seduced by this very charismatic serial killer and being fooled, being deceived by his routine, and it follows sees it mostly through the life of his longtime girlfriend who for a very long time did not know any of this, and you know, because he was so charismatic and charming, and if you look at the old footage of him, you know, he is all those things, and which is why he was able to get away with what he did for so long. People said this is glorifying serial killers. I don't think so. I mean, a title like that is not glorifying serial killers. It is demonstrating. It is showing, you know, what happens when you know, somebody with those kind of resources and that kind of intelligence, but who is completely, you know, sociopathic, how far they can go.
Yeah. And then what about the film Untouchable? I mean, of course, over the years you've covered Harvey Weinstein and his tantrums and mm-hmm. buying frenzies. But what about the film? You did have a report earlier this week on the women who spoke up in the film.
Right.
But what about the film itself?
The film itself is, a necessary film, I think, because it does really put together in one place all of the stuff that has been reported on by New York Times, the New York Times reporters, by Ronan Farrow and The New Yorker, all of whom, you know, those reporters are all interviewed in the film along with others. And it really does piece together not just the stuff he did, which was horrible, but also the system that was built around him that allowed him to get away with it. Because he had money, because he was able to make money, because he was able to turn people into movie stars, because he was able to take little film, you know, buy little films here at the festival, like Sex, Lies, and Videotape and Reservoir Dogs and Clerks. The fact that, you know, he could do that allowed a lot of people to ignore or put aside all the stuff that was hanging out there like red flags all along. I think it was important to have that movie here because this was his stomping ground where he found those movies and we made those stars. It's also important because, you know, at least three cases of assault that have been reported happened in hotels in Park City. So, it was very definitely an important thing to have here.
Yeah. In terms of, do you basically write your own script for your Sundance coverage? Or, I mean, are you assigned to do certain stories? I mean, you know more than anyone.
We work as a team. I mean, I talk to my editors. We have a couple other reporters who are credentialed, and we go over the list of the films that are here, and we go over the, you know, what's available to us, and we work together. I'm not telling my editors what to do, and you know, I'm definitely making suggestions, but it's definitely, you know, collaborative between the editors and myself.
So yeah. What does the future bring for Sean Means as a critic in this more evolving age of, you know, declining film criticism. I mean, I was taken aback by, you know, my Boston guy, Wesley Morris, you know, a critic at large status now after Grantland went off the air, and had to do essentially an op-ed last week when he was writing about Black Klansmen in the Oscars. And the Mix last week had, I think, two cut and paste AP reviews and a Washington Post review in addition to your guys' coverage. So that's a bit of a transition. Is that in your control, or is that just part of playing at what is moving forward?
Well, I mean, my title right now is Digital Life Reporter. So I'm doing a lot. I mean, I'm doing not so much reviews for the Tribune, because my time and my efforts can be better put to work elsewhere. I do a lot of straight reporting. I do a lot of arts and entertainment reporting, and a lot of breaking news as well. And that's the life we all have now in newspapers. Everybody does a little bit of everything. Having such deep specialties, unless it's like, you know, topics like, you know, politics or religion or so on, you do need people with a deep understanding of those to cover them. But a lot of us, you know, we basically go where we need to be covering, go where the news is.
Yeah. How is that working? I mean, with, gosh, so much of the workforce cut, it's a lot of work.
Well, the Tribune is alive and thriving, hanging in there. Our local ownership is, you know, very supportive of us. The fact that we are not part of, you know, some company that is only trying to bleed us dry, which a lot of, you know, there's a particular hedge fund that used to own the Tribune that you know, gets written up in the trades a lot, the less said about them the better, but you know, with the Hunson family owning the Tribune, they've shown a lot of support, and they are encouraging us and pushing us to you know, put out the best newspaper we can put out.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you also, what did you make about Robert Redford kind of just handing off the opening day press conference to his staff?
That was quite interesting, because I mean, he basically put in a cameo. He's never been particularly fond of that duty, of having to explain over and over again to reporters, you know, what the mission of the Sundance Institute and the Sundance Film Festival are, and he rightly says that, you know, the festival is pretty much, you know, I don't say runs itself, but it has made its case, and people know and people understand what Sundance is here for. So he doesn't need to make that case anymore. And he you know, he announced last year that he was going to retire from acting after his last movie. He's in an age and at a point in his life where he's like, you know, if I don't have to do it, I don't want it. If I don't want to do it, I don't have to do it. And he's making that point, and he's getting a chance to enjoy, as one of the people I talked to said, he's getting to enjoy what he built, and which is very cool. I think he has built this thing, and it's at a point where it can operate without his, you know, direct hand on it all the time.
Yeah. And then in terms of with our new director of programming taking over for Trevor Groth, Kim Yutani, mm-hmm. she seemed to be very proud of the program she put together, and I'm saying it's the most diverse that they've ever had.
Right. Kim has been great. She's she's a different personality type than Trevor, certainly. She's a little quieter, and she's getting better at the part of the job that requires, you know, being the public speaker. That comes with time and practice, and she's getting better at that all the time. She definitely, you know, they have definitely put together a great program. Like I said, very few clunkers in the whole thing. But the other thing is that she's been very adamant about talking about diversity, bringing in voices that Hollywood doesn't bring in. You had the Time's Up challenge, the 4% challenge, talked about here in Park City this week, where actors and studios are being challenged to get more women directors working, and that, you know, actors are promising they will work with a female director within the next 18 months, that sort of thing. And, you know, when you consider that for the festival, You know, some 45-46% of the films here have at least one woman director on. You know, either directed by a woman or directed by a team that's at least one woman in it. And you compare that to Hollywood, where the top 100 grossing films last year, 4% were directed by women. You know, Hollywood has a ways to go, and I think Sundance, by showing how diversity works and by being transparent about it and having the data and having the numbers behind it, they can act as an example to Hollywood on how to make it work.
Well, that was one of the things that struck me about Apollo 13 when they got up after the film and lined up, and it was like, wow, that lineup of all of the film and crew looked a lot like the inside of the Kennedy Space Center, you know, in Houston. Mm-hmm. White males.
A bunch of dudes, yeah.
Yeah. This is, how many years you've been covering?
This is 26th that I've covered.
Yeah, and your sense, you said no clunkers, but I mean, what's your sense of Sundance Film Festival?
Well, let me ask it a different way. Yeah. With the festivals, the other part of their mission, as I understand it, is they also seem to be given a higher or a larger platform to films that come through their development and labs. Do you think that presents challenges or opportunities or both?
I think mostly opportunities. They do bring in, a lot of the lab projects do wind up here, but there's a lot of lab projects that don't. And they are very good at separating out. I mean, part of it is that they know these lab, because they know these lab projects are coming, because, they're all in the same office in LA or in Park City. So they talk to each other. They know things. They track projects through the year to see, okay, are you going to be ready to submit for the festival? But they track them, but at the same time, they are very aware of things that come over the transom from places they've never heard of. They're very aware that even though a movie is at the lab, doesn't mean it's going to be, perfect or good enough for the purposes of the festival. I think they're very scrupulous about that. And take great pains not to let the fact that a movie was a lab project unduly influence them. I mean, it's still got to stand up on its own along with all the others. And because there are so many others, 4,000 feature films submitted this year, 9,000 some short films, they pour through them all and to come up with the 120 or whatever that play here.
Well, I'm going to let you go. I know you got some films to get to. I always appreciate you spending some time with us and kind of your thoughts about it. That's the Salt Lake Tribune's digital life reporter, Sean Means. Thanks.
Happy to be here.